132 rooms. The governor's mansion in Austin has a small lawn and simple gardens. The place itself is hemmed in by a cross-section of city streets, pinning it to its urban spot amid blocks of stone office fronts and the slow progression of glinting high-rises. On the morning of March 2, 1999, a state staffer placed two white metal lawn chairs in the garden, and others hung a small rope to hold back the crush of television cameras, photographers, and reporters who had come to hear George announce that he was forming an exploratory committee to consider making a presidential run. The announcement of an exploratory committee was, we both knew, the same as an official declaration. I sat beside George, smiling, but I had been late to sign on to his decision to run. Politics had turned ugly during his dad's 1992 race with Bill Clinton. I had watched political opponents and the media draw the most hideous caricatures of George H.W. Bush, until I barely recognized my own father-in-law. I believed in my George. I love him, and I knew he would be a great president. It was the process in which I had far less faith. My escape, and at moments my salvation from this particular trail, was to come in the form of nearly 1,600 acres of blackland prairie and an extended finger of the Texas Hill Country, a ranch near the town named Crawford. My childhood fantasies of El Paso ranchland had matured into a dream of a quiet frame house on the banks of the Guadalupe or the Medina River, where a slow, gradual lawn dipped down to gurgling river waters or a meandering feeder creek. I imagined children or grandchildren playing in its currents and the soft rustle of branches from clusters of sturdy cypress trees rooted to its banks. In late February of 1998, George and I went to look at a plot of land in north central Texas, almost dead center between Austin and Dallas. It was flat, tall grass prairie, the bits of flinty range where generations of farmers and ranchers had eked out life with their livestock. Amid the fields and pastures, there were fence lines and tree breaks and a healthy breeze, but nothing to distinguish this spot from thousands of other working farms and ranches across the Texas landscape. Then George drove me in. In the back, the grassland abruptly sheared away into seven box canyons, their walls covered in steep limestone, worn down from water and ancient geological upheaval. Thousands of years of erosion had left jutting bits of giant rock, some of which the rain, sun, and wind have chiseled away, until their features resembled the noses, eyes, and lips of Easter Island's silent Moai figures. In centuries past, the Tonkawa Indian warriors rested and watered their horses in this part of the Bosque River, and horse thieves hid their bounty along the winding canyon bottoms. This back edge was what old-time ranchers called sorry land, uncleared, untamed, a tangle of brambles and overhanging limbs. Much of it was impassable. We could only hike to the top ledge and look down. It was rugged and stark. For George, it was love at first sight. I was far less smitten. 2 months later, the following April, I was driving with Reagan and the rest of my Austin Garden Club to an event in Fort Worth. We were heading up Interstate 35, and the land alongside was swollen with green grass shoots and carpeted with bluebonnets and other wildflowers, bright and plump from drenching spring rains. As I watched the grasses and the flowers bend in the wind, I realized that this was exactly the section of Texas where the Crawford Ranch was, and that the blooming land was beautiful. We had money from the sale of the Texas Rangers baseball team. I called George from the car and said, "Let's buy it." By August, the land was ours. Scattered around the front half of the 1,600 acres were a small 1940s farmhouse, which faced two diesel storage tanks and a tractor shed, a livestock barn, and a few other outbuildings. After George won his re-election race for Texas governor in November of 1998, with 68% of the vote statewide, I started work on the modest 6-room house, updating and refurbishing it. Then my eyes turned to the grassland. In 1999, as George was weighing his presidential run, I embarked on a prairie restoration. Over a series of years, we cleared 40 acres and covered them with seed for native grasses. In our final year of seeding, 2007, the rains came, 56 inches of them. The grasses took and the prairie returned. We then began adding another 40 acres of native prairie grassland. Susan Reif, head of the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, has noted that our little project is the largest private, completely native prairie restoration in all of Texas. I feel a twinge of sadness when I think of the millions of acres across West Texas that were once alive with tall prairie. Big bluestem, Indian grass, and switchgrass have vanished from the landscape as thoroughly as the thundering buffalo herds. Campaigning for office is like running a marathon, day after day. You wake in the darkness and sleep when the local news anchors are just signing off. You sleep in motels and hotel chains, on a hard pillow one night and a soft one the next. Or you sleep upright on the plane itself. Your life is packed between the two sides of a suitcase. Barb Bush once spoke to a group of Motel 6 owners and told them that people think she has Ritz-Carlton written all over her. But in fact, she spent far more nights in a Motel 6. To be on the trail requires tremendous physical and emotional stamina and energy. Even the press sometimes has it easier than the candidates. If a reporter catches the flu, he or she can hop off the trail for a day or two to recover, but not the candidate. If George or I got that same flu, we couldn't get off. We had to keep traveling to every event. This constant life on the road meant that I missed things, too. I missed Barbara and Jenna's high school senior homecoming ceremony. At halftime during the big school football game, Barbara was going to be crowned homecoming queen, but she didn't know it. Austin Hyde called me that afternoon to tell me in secret so that I could be there. Instead, we were heading for the airport. The only person I told was George's personal aide and our dear friend, Israel Hernandez, who had been with George and our family since 1992. Izzy tried to get her to dress up, but Barbara went off to the game wearing flip-flops. But we always came home, not simply to the governor's mansion, which was temporary, but to the land of Prairie Chapel Ranch, which we named for the tiny historic chapel down the road. George's first suggestion had been the Lazy L Ranch. Working with architect David Heyman, we designed and built a new house. On Saturdays, we drove out with David and walked the property, imagining. David's gift was siding a home where it would have the best views, the best breezes, the best flood of sunlight. Along a small rise stood a cluster of large old live oaks and cedar elms. There was just enough space to situate the house in the middle of those gnarled trees. The house itself is split in the style of old Texas ranch houses, with a breezeway, or what they used to call a dog trot, running through the center. When early Texans built a house, they would have a covered porch open to the breeze so they could work there in the heat of the day, with the prevailing winds drawing through to provide some cool. Our own entry hall has wide screens to capture the wind and doors that open into the living room to usher through the breeze. I wanted the house to be low and to fit into the landscape. It was only when the house was nearly finished that my friend Peggy Weiss came to look at it and observed that what we'd built looked like a Midland house. And it was, only a single story and following the ground, just like the houses Daddy used to build. We wanted the house not simply to fit into the landscape, but to be of the landscape. So we used Luter's limestone from a quarry that was about 40 miles away, and we chose the top and bottom pieces of the quarry cuts, the ones with streaks of color. Those are considered the discard pieces, because most builders want only the creamy white centers. But the leftovers are feathered with warm streaks of ochre, and rose and look like the burnished tips of prairie grasses. The floors are poured concrete or wide plank wood, and we did not build a single stair. We want to live at that ranch house when we are in our walkers and our wheelchairs, should that day ever come. As the presidential primary season unfolded in 2000, slab was being poured and walls were taking form. We were building for the rest of our lives. In the late summer, George invited Dick Cheney to the ranch. Dick had been a longtime Wyoming congressman and Gampy's Secretary of Defense during the Gulf War. George liked Dick's thoughtful, measured demeanor and had asked Dick to head up his vice presidential search. I'd long liked and admired his wife, Lynn, who had overseen the National Endowment for the Humanities and is an accomplished scholar and author in her own right. Dick arrived with crisp file folders and sheaths of paper covering each possible vice presidential pick. But the more the two men spoke, the more George began to think that Dick himself was the best partner and candidate. He possessed the perfect combination of experience in Congress and the executive branch, and he had what George and I would call a quiet strength. As their meetings drew to a close, George asked Dick to be his running mate. He agreed, and there were so many times when we were both glad that Dick Cheney was the nation's vice president. There were some things that I insisted upon during the campaign. I insisted upon leaving the trail to move the girls into their new schools. When she was a sophomore in high school, Jenna had asked me to reserve a space for her at the Hardin House, a private dorm at the University of Texas in Austin. Even when I was heading to college, Miss Hardin's, as it was known then, was the place for young UT co-eds to live. Jenna would live with two other girls in one room. They had all made their reservations together. We arrived and promptly went out to buy bed risers so that we could slide the storage boxes packed with Jenna's clothes underneath her bed frame. The other girls were doing the same. I thought of my own move-in day at SMU. My suitcase and a couple of boxes had fit neatly in the car trunk. I left Jenna with her friends and headed up to New Haven for Barbara. Barbara had already spent a week camping in the wilderness as part of Yale's outdoor orientation program, which she adored. She arrived for move-in, desperate for a shower. But first, we had to get her things up the narrow, Gothic-style stairways of Yale's centuries-old dorm. We spent what seemed like hours navigating the turns and dark stairwells, and then came the negotiations with her new roommate over who would get the bottom bunk. A half hour of my negotiating prowess resulted in Barbara sleeping on the top bunk all year. With the girls in school, I was gone from my empty nest as well, back out on the campaign trail full time. I've always found presidential debates to be nerve-wracking. I spent one of Gampy's presidential debates in bed with the covers pulled up to my eyes, and now I had to sit composed and almost expressionless through three debates between George and Al Gore. George went into the first debate trailing in the polls, but his focused answers, combined with Al Gore's grimaces and audible sighs, changed the dynamic of the race. By the time the third debate was over, George was 10 points ahead in the polls. Now, as the days ticked down, we were trying to cover as many states and as much of the country as possible before the election. The attacks grew nastier, the tone sharper. Election night for a candidate's wife is largely about supporting your spouse. There are no speeches to give, no questions to answer. It's a mime performance of waves and gestures, and on your face, the look of radiant relief at victory or brave composure at defeat. I had chosen a royal blue suit to carry me through from dinner to the returns and whatever lay beyond. In the final 36 hours, we had barnstormed from Florida through Texas, finally touching down in Austin so we could go back home to the governor's residence and get up the next morning to vote. That evening, before 7 p.m., we got the news that Florida was being called for Gore, along with Michigan, The family gathered in the governor's mansion, and Jeb began furiously working the phones. When the first election call was made, the polls had not even closed in the Florida panhandle, which is in a separate time zone, 1 hour earlier than the rest of the state. Voter News Service had made their prediction based on the morning's and afternoon's exit polls. The night was dark and rainy. Barb Bush was sitting on the sofa with a needlepoint canvas and a pair of earphones, listening to a Sandra Brown novel. She stitched and listened, as the minutes dragged by. I went into the kitchen to make coffee and unload and reload the dishwasher, as mugs and glasses were filled and refilled. Then a little after 9 p.m. Texas time, the networks retracted their calls. At a little after 1 a.m., Florida was recalled for George. George stepped into the hallway to review his acceptance speech. The cars were waiting to take us over to the rain-soaked Capitol, and our supporters began leaving their hotels to line the grounds. Many of our best friends from around the country had flown in for the night. Thousands more people were already waiting for the man they thought would be the president-elect to arrive. Then, at about 1:30 in the morning, 2:30 on the East Coast, Al Gore phoned to congratulate George and concede. The election was truly over. George hugged me, hugged his parents and his brother. My mother was on the verge of tears. Our celebration lasted about 20 minutes. One by one, the networks announced that Florida was again too close to call. An hour after his first phone call, Al Gore called George back to retract his concession. There was not to be an election night after all. I looked around our small living room. Everyone was exhausted. After years of being on the road almost every night of every week, of working so incredibly hard, there was to be no resolution this night. I walked over to George, wrapped my arms around him, and said, "Bushy, would you rather win or go to bed?" He looked at me, laughed, and said, "Go to bed." Sometime after 3 a.m., after Don Evans, George's campaign chair, had gone out to speak to the press and our supporters in Austin to tell them that he believed, when it's all said and done, we will prevail, I finally sent everyone off to their hotel rooms or their homes for what little sleep they could get. We assumed things would look different in the morning. We had no way of knowing that our election night would not end for another 35 days. I look back on that recount period as endless and simultaneously brief. I ate, I walked, I read, but where and what I'm no longer entirely sure. I hosted the book festival and the black tie events, and like the tick-tock of a metronome, the counting continued. In Austin, there were protesters on the streets, but most of them were backing George. We saw the golfer Ben Crenshaw and his wife Julie pushing their little baby in a stroller and holding up signs of support. Many of our closest friends were walking around the governor's mansion with signs, too. In Washington, Daro, George's sister, joined the protesters outside the vice president's residence. But we also knew the vice president's house from George's dad. And I could imagine the Gores being cooped up in there high on the hill, waiting, just as we were. There was nothing to do but wait. On November 7th, we already thought we had won, and it was now up to the lawyers and the courts. The ultimate decision was out of our hands. Then on December 12th, Election 2000 finally came to an end. The Supreme Court issued two decisions. The first was a 7-2 ruling that the manual Florida vote recount had violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution because not all ballots were treated alike in all Florida counties. On what the appropriate remedy to recount should be, the ruling was much closer. By a 5-4 decision, the justices ruled that there was no fair way to recount all the votes yet again and allow Florida to participate in the Electoral College. The current vote count would stand. George was declared the winner. Months later, when most of the major media outlets conducted their own series of recounts, he still won. On December 18th, I returned to Washington. I had a new title, First Lady Designate, and I was going to be shown the White House by Senator-elect Hillary Rodham Clinton. Hillary Clinton was waiting for us on the South Portico, with plans to move out and to assume her role in the Senate. She had been running late that morning, but in the press reports, I was the one who was chided for tardiness and for my clothes. That's the struggle with trying to find news when you have 20 cameras trained on two women greeting each other at a doorway for a private tea. What seemed most interesting is often mostly wrong. When my big black car pulled up and the Secret Service agents appeared, they couldn't open the car doors. The agents tugged at the handles while we stayed stuck inside, smiling gamely, and Hillary stood waiting awkwardly. Finally, someone figured out how to release the locks. Once I stepped out, Hillary was gracious and forthcoming. There's a particular kinship that develops between the spouses of political leaders. I had it with many of the governor's wives, and I would continue to have it with former first ladies and the wives of many foreign leaders. There was a similarity, and at times a strangeness to our shared circumstances that created an instant bond. It's a kinship I felt regardless of political persuasion, and I felt it that morning at the double-door entrance to the South Portico with Hillary, as she began our tour of the public house and the private living quarters and offered me her very candid advice. She even told me that if she had it to do all over again, she would not have had an office in the West Wing, that she seldom used it after the healthcare debate ended. And I do know many women who wonder to this day why it is still referred to as Hillary's healthcare plan rather than the Clinton healthcare plan when it was done under the auspices of her husband, the president. Joined by Chelsea, Hillary led me through the lower level, sharing with me her fond recollections of the parties they had hosted in the Palm Room, the glassed-in conservatory that divides the formal White House from the West Wing. It was a brief tour through their public and private lives, a whirlwind of parties arranged in the Blue Room, the Red Room, and the Green Room, until I could almost glimpse the tables and the sprayed gold banquet chairs. But when we went up to the state floor, both Hillary and I had forgotten about the public tours. She opened the door to lead me through the formal staterooms, and we caught sight of a large tour group. She quickly shut the door, but not before some very surprised tourists got a good look at the outgoing and the incoming first ladies. We moved upstairs to the family quarters, where at one point Chelsea said, "Mom, tell Mrs. Bush about the tomato plants," and Hillary led me out onto the parapet off the third floor, where each spring they set out pots of tomato plants, because you just can't get good tomatoes. I nodded my head and smiled and thought, tomatoes? You can't get good tomatoes at the White House? But George and I also grew pots of tomatoes on the parapet. We were standing in the First Lady's dressing room when Hillary paused and remembered something that Barbara Bush had shown her 8 years before. "Your mother-in-law stood right here and told me that from this window you can see straight down into the Rose Garden and also over to the Oval Office, and you can watch what's going on." I did look out that window many times over the years, out to the Rose Garden and around the grounds, always careful to stand just inside the frame so that no one would spot me. If George was doing an event in the Rose Garden, I could see it from the window and live on television at the same time. I finished that day by interviewing potential staff members for my new East Wing office at the White House. The last candidate had 4 legs and was 10 weeks old. He was a Scottish Terrier puppy, born to a dog owned by New Jersey Governor Christy Todd Whitman, and of course, I fell in love. We named him Barney. We already had a Springer Spaniel, Spot, one of the 6 puppies born to Barr's dog, Millie, in 1989 when she lived in the White House. All our animals in Dallas were named for Texas Rangers baseball players. Spot got her name in honor of the infielder, Scott Fletcher, Barbara's favorite player. Of course, the Rangers almost immediately traded Scott. Our cat was named after Ruben Sierra, whose nickname, El Indio, gave Kitty her name, La India. And at times, I would look at our pets and remember our girls and our lives, the family that we were beyond the White House walls. Inauguration Day dawned cold and rainy, but to George and me, the morning was beautiful. We began with a church service at the nearby St. John's Episcopal Church. The creamy yellow building held its first service in 1816. Its nearly 1,000-pound steeple bell was cast by Paul Revere's son. Every president since James Madison has worshipped there. Pew 54 is designated as the president's pew. St. John's became our Washington church while we were at the White House. It was where we had attended services in 1988 when George had been working on his father's presidential campaign. Listening to the sermon and the prayers provided our last moments for tranquil reflection. From St. John's, we would be whisked from event to event. Each second of our day would be accounted for, and the clock was unyielding. After the service, we drove straight across Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, where Bill and Hillary Clinton were waiting to greet us for the traditional coffee. The Cheneys came, as did Al and Tipper Gore. Then we departed in our motorcade for the Capitol, George and Bill Clinton riding in the president's car, and Hillary and me following behind. As we chatted on the short drive, I thought of how, in most cases, a First Lady's departure day is the start of her retirement. For Hillary, it was the beginning of her own career. And nearly 2 years after George had held his press conference in the garden of the Texas Governor's Mansion, he was going to be sworn in as the 43rd President of the United States, and only the second presidential son to hold the office himself. History would now record John Adams and John Quincy Adams and George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. As we rode up Pennsylvania Avenue, I saw a collection of protesters waving placards and calling George's election illegitimate. Until that moment, I had thought that once the winner was formally declared, the post-election rancor would die down, that everyone would move on. But in the years to come, we found that for some, the bitterness remained. There is no grand entrance to be made for the outgoing president and his incoming successor. We entered through a side door at the Capitol into a rather ordinary hallway, distinguished only by two moderately sized gilded eagles perched at the top of each wall. From there, it was off to an interior room to wait. Outside, invited guests and spectators had been gathering for hours, even with the rain. Now, with the noon hour approaching, it was George's time. We began our walk the same basic route that I had taken for Gampy's inaugurals. We crossed the sturdy crypt, built to support the soaring dome of the Capitol Rotunda. Lynn Cheney was my companion. George, as the incoming president, would be the last to take his place on the podium. From the crypt, we climbed the stairs to the magnificent rotunda, ringed by statues and enormous paintings of Revolutionary War scenes, the landing of the Pilgrims, the discovery of the Mississippi, and the baptism of Pocahontas. We passed them all as if in a blur. There was barely time to glance up at the fresco in the dome, painted to glorify George Washington. As we left the rotunda, we walked down a steep set of stairs in a very ordinary hallway. No decorations, just wide-cut gray stone blocks bathed in darkness, except for the blinding array of television lights waiting to illuminate us as we descended. But from the small doorway, Washington, D.C. was spread before us. The vast expanse of the Mall, the tall, spare point of the Washington Monument, the wide colonnade of the Lincoln Memorial, and the blocks of hard granite buildings lining the avenues. Their edges were soft as if in a dream, because a cool mist had settled over the city. And even though I had seen the exact same view three other times, on this day, that sight, for those few seconds, was uniquely ours. I tried to savor it all, the oath of office, the inaugural address, the military band, the friends and family who had come to share the day. For me, the inauguration is the thing of beauty, the scene that will last when all others have faded away. I was grateful for the days we'd already spent in the White House with Ganny and Gampy. Parts of it are warrens of rooms and alcoves and doorways. There are 132 rooms housed inside its walls. At first, my assistant, Sarah Moss, who worked in an upstairs office in the residence, would get lost just trying to find the elevator foyer. I might not be entirely certain of what I was going to do as First Lady, but at least, right away, I could find the elevator. As for George, he was shocked when two members of the residence staff, Sam Sutton and Fidel Medina, introduced themselves to him as the president's valets. George took his dad aside and said, "I don't think I need a valet." Gampy smiled and told him, "Don't worry, you'll get used to it." Tony and Cherie Blair were coming to visit at the end of February, and we invited them to be our first international guests at Camp David. Nestled in the Catoctin Mountains of Maryland, Camp David has been a presidential retreat since the time of Franklin Roosevelt, who called it Shangri-La. President Dwight Eisenhower renamed it for his grandson, David. Camp David is a nickname for Naval Support Facility Thermont, and it's an active naval base. Marines and Navy sailors work and often live on the grounds. The camp itself spans 180 acres, and the presidential section consists of a series of comfortable cabins tucked away among the trees and connected by winding paths. Franklin Roosevelt met with Winston Churchill at Camp David. Ronald Reagan had invited Margaret Thatcher, and Gampy had hosted John Major. It is a real treat to show off the White House in its full splendor to visiting heads of state or government, to introduce them to celebrities and other famous Americans. But entertaining at a place like Camp David, or later at our ranch, was far more relaxed and casual. A visit to Camp David is more like a visit to someone's weekend place, and it cements a different friendship than simply having a fancy event amid gleaming silver and glittering chandeliers. We could visit with our guest over coffee at breakfast, or have dinner and then watch a movie. For the Blairs, it was Meet the Parents. Leaders who came to visit us at the White House stayed across the street at Blair House and invariably showed up at night on the front steps in black tie. I was a bit nervous about meeting the Blairs. I knew what close friends they had been with Bill and Hillary Clinton, and I wondered how we would get along. The British tabloids didn't help. Clash of Cherie and W's Cowgirl headlined the Daily Record. Frosty forecast as our modern mum meets Bush's little woman at summit. The Brits were convinced that it would be torture for Cherie Blair to sit down and have a meal alone with me while George and Tony got to know each other. "Laura is a cookie-baking homemaker," they wrote, "dull, mumsy, and old-fashioned." At least with the British press, one never needs to say, "Tell us what you really think." But Cherie Blair and I did hit it off when we had our private lunch in Aspen Lodge, the president's cabin, while George and Tony Blair and their staffs had a working afternoon at Laurel, the main lodge. Cherie is funny and smart, and we talked about our families. Her oldest children and Jenna and Barbara are close in age. We enjoyed talking about topics like women's issues and improving women's health, although what I liked most about our friendship was the intimacy of it, rather like two busy mothers catching up over coffee. Cherie is a wonderful reader, and we shared a love of books and more than a few favorite authors. She was attuned to the challenges of being an American First Lady. In England, the Prime Minister's wife has no official title and few official responsibilities. Cherie was proud to have kept her day job as a barrister in the British courts. The only thing I felt bad about on this visit was that I don't think the Blairs, Cherie especially, were all that keen on pets. We, of course, had ferried Kitty, Barney, and Spot to Camp David. I asked Cherie if they had any animals, and she paused and answered, "Well, we had a gerbil once." The day that the Blairs arrived, I had spent part of the morning with Oprah Winfrey. There was tremendous curiosity about me as the new First Lady, and although I hadn't really done anything yet, reporters from across the country wanted me to sit for interviews. The Washington Post, Good Morning America, the Texas Papers, Harper's Bazaar, People, Reuters, the list was long and growing. I was waiting upstairs for Oprah, who arrived with her best friend and business partner, Gail King. But before they were escorted to the upper level, George passed by with Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor, and Colin Powell, his secretary of state. My staff later told me that Oprah was speechless at meeting them. For the first time, the two individuals tasked with overseeing U.S. foreign policy were African American. Gail King had to give Oprah a little poke to remind her to talk, and I thought later what a wonderful moment to have this crossroads of success in the people's house that was at the founding of the nation, built by the labor of unknown and unrecognized slaves. In March, I began my education initiatives in earnest. I started out wanting to replicate some of my most successful Texas projects on a national scale. I made school visits to highlight innovative educational programs and started planning an early childhood cognitive development conference to be held in Washington that summer. My other chief focus was teacher recruitment, positive ways to entice more people to work in our nation's schools and classrooms. I began by working with two programs, Teach for America and Troops to Teachers, which encourages members of the military who are retiring from the service to go into teaching. In less than 10 years, it had sent almost 4,000 troops into teaching. And there was another idea that I wanted to initiate, a national book festival, to bring some of the nation's leading authors to Washington and, with the help of cable television C-SPAN, carry their words to the country at large. I had seen the overwhelming success of the Texas Book Festival, and I believe that it could have even more meaning on a national scale. The Library of Congress would be the perfect co-sponsor and a perfect venue to celebrate authors and promote reading and literacy. For Easter, we went to the ranch. It was the first time we had spent the night in our new home, and George was thrilled to stand in the finished rooms that we had imagined and planned together for so long. We were up for sunrise services at the Canaan Baptist Church down the road, and the world that morning had the tranquil sense of being at peace. Mother came back with us to Washington, and 4 days later, George, Mother, and I were in the Capitol Rotunda for the ceremonies to mark the Day of Remembrance. We watched as flags from each American military unit that had liberated the Nazi death camps were carried in. Mother and I waited side by side, trying to remember which flag and which unit was Daddy's. Then suddenly we saw it, the Timberwolf flag, with its signature wolf, head up, mouth open, as if in full howl, and we both burst into tears. All those years, we had kept his photographs tucked away in that box, but they were so small, and this horror was so large. For that moment, as we stood watching that flag and remembering, Daddy was with us. We felt such overwhelming sadness that day, yet we felt safe. On that morning, we never contemplated the face of other evils that might slip in. One of the invitations that crossed my desk that spring was for the opening of the Metropolitan Museum of Art's exhibition of Jacqueline Kennedy's dresses. The invitation offered the option of bringing guests, so I asked Reagan and her daughter Laura and Barbara to join me. We arrived at the museum and were met in the receiving line by Anna Winter, the editor of Vogue, as well as the designer Oscar de la Renta and Caroline Kennedy. It was my first ever New York designer affair. At 31, Jackie Kennedy was such a young woman when her husband became president. Yet she left a rich legacy in decorating and conserving the White House. For me, the most moving story was her last project, the Oval Office. While the President and First Lady were on a pre-Thanksgiving trip, the White House staff had installed her newly chosen curtains and other furnishings. The trip that Jackie and John F. Kennedy made was to Dallas. Before she returned to the White House as a widow, the staff removed the new decor, restoring the Oval Office to the way President Kennedy had left it, the one thing in the home that could still be returned to the way it had been. After the receiving line, we had to ascend the museum's grand marble staircase to reach the exhibition. Someone had cleverly lined the staircase with violinists, and I believe a few trumpeters. Orchestra members stretched the entire way up. But it was a bit too clever. There was no way to grab onto the handrail. So there I was, holding up my gown and climbing those stairs, hoping that I wouldn't step on my dress, and thinking, please don't trip and fall. And later I heard that women in their long gowns did tumble on the marble stairs. It was instructive to me, though. I never lined the marble White House stairs with anyone so that all guests could easily grasp the handrail. We were guided through the collection by Hamish Bowles, the impeccably groomed Vogue contributor. I gazed at the dark red boucle day dress that Jackie Kennedy had worn to give the television tour of the White House, which Americans saw only in black and white, as well as her crepe silk evening gowns and apricot silk dresses. When we came to her inaugural clothes, Hamish said, "This is what one should wear to the inaugurations, pearl gray. It isn't turquoise blue or something like that." I love Jackie Kennedy's clothes because they were the clothes I'd grown up seeing as a young woman. I remember a classic pink coat that I bought at Neiman Marcus when I was at SMU, which I kept tucked away in paper for years, hoping Barbara or Jenna might want it when they were grown. But there is something different about seeing another First Lady's clothes on display. I knew my inaugural gown would be joining the gown collection at the Smithsonian. But there's more to it than that. There is the strange knowledge that how you look will be critiqued and that what you wear will likely end up on display. Nancy Reagan told me a few years ago that when the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library put together a showing of her clothes, it became the most visited exhibit in the entire library. She laughed when she said it, adding, "You know, those clothes that I was always criticized for." I was like all first ladies in that I wanted to look good. I knew how interested the public and the press are in what first ladies wear. Like the women before me, I wanted to look elegant, to appear my best at events here and abroad, and not to glance back later at White House photos and silently cringe. I really felt sorry for Hillary Clinton, who spent years having the press write nasty things about her hairstyles. It unnerved me enough that I paid with our own money for someone to come to the White House and blow-dry my hair almost every morning, just so I could try to avoid a bad hair day. But while some first ladies are genuinely interested in fashion, I'm not one who follows each new season's trends. I've been wearing the same suits, sweaters, and slacks for years. Jackie Kennedy is always going to be more stylish. She was from a part of the country and a part of society that cultivated a certain style and manner. East Coast elegance was exotically enchanting, but also out of reach to sweater-set girls in Midland. The daily hair blow dries were just one of the monetary costs of living in the White House. Most Americans may not realize that presidents and their families are responsible for their personal costs while they reside at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and that George and I paid for ours out of our own pockets. The presidential room, as it were, is covered, but not the board. The house we had to live in was spectacular. We lived with luxuries that we could not have afforded in our private life, such as an exquisite home and furnishings, a full staff, a chef, and a fully staffed weekend retreat at Camp David. Presidents and their families are fortunately not responsible for a White House mortgage or the White House utility bills, and it's more than fair that they pay for their personal items like every American household. George and I covered the costs for our own food each month, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, at the White House and at Camp David. And if the girls came home or if we had friends to dinner or guests who stayed overnight, we were billed for their food as well. We paid for our dry cleaning and outside laundry. And if we hosted a private party as we did when George's parents celebrated their 60th wedding anniversary, we paid the expenses ourselves, including the hourly wages for the waiters and servers and the setup and cleanup crews who needed to receive time and a half if the party was held after 5 o'clock p.m. Every month we received an itemized bill for our living and personal expenses at the White House. But there were some costs that I was not prepared for. I was amazed by the sheer number of designer clothes that I was expected to buy, like the women before me, to meet the fashion expectations for a first lady. After our first year in the White House, our accountant said to George, "It costs a lot to be president," and he was referring mainly to my clothes. Of course, I recycled most of my wardrobe, wearing the same dress to the White House Correspondents' Dinner in the spring, and then again to the Congressional Ball in December. But heavily photographed occasions, like state dinners or the annual Kennedy Center Honors, required new gowns each time. There were times when the recycling went too far. One Sunday morning, I arrived at Fox News for an interview with Chris Wallace. Looking around at the photos in the green room, I saw that I'd worn the exact same suit to my last interview with Chris. Quickly, I exchanged tops with my press secretary so that it would seem as if I had a bit more wardrobe variety. To look my best abroad, I employed a hairdresser to accompany me on overseas trips. And if I needed professional makeup for a state event or a television interview, I paid for that as well. Today, I like to flip through home decorating magazines while I dry my own hair. On Friday, April 27th, George and I were at our ranch after having spent most of the day in Austin for the dedication of the Bob Bullock Texas State History Museum. The next day, we would return to Washington for the White House Correspondents Association dinner. It was early on that day when the phone rang. Jenna was on the line in tears. She had been cited the night before for ordering drinks in a bar in Austin and being underage with a fake ID. By the time Jenna called us, nothing we could have said would have made her feel any worse, but we still gave her a stern talk. Her picture was splashed across the television and newspapers. She would be part of local news film footage and the slightly blurry image at the end of a photographer's long-range telephoto lens. We told her that this would be a lesson and one that she had learned the hard way. Her friends might do something wrong and not make headlines, but she did not have that luxury. Almost immediately, a warm note of encouragement arrived for Jenna and Barbara from Lucy Johnson, who shared with them the advice her own mother, Lady Bird, gave to her and Linda. "Don't do anything that you wouldn't want to read about on the front page of the New York Times, because if you do, it will be." That night in Austin was just dumb, in the way that so many 19-year-olds are dumb. I remember a line from the number one ladies' detective agency, a series of novels by Alexander McCall Smith, in which his main character, Precious Ramotswe, says, "21-year-olds are so stupid, and there's so many of them." To her credit, Jenna rose to the occasion. She quit going to clubs and other places in downtown Austin. And for years, I've talked to both Barbara and Jenna about the risks of alcohol. Their father quit drinking. My father overdrank. And I've warned both of them about the perils of alcohol, saying nothing good ever happens when you're drunk. But what bothered me long after the incident was over was the image left behind in the public mind that Barbara and Jenna were party girls. Most of the snippets about them that ended up on the news were nothing like our daughters. Many were just plain wrong. Otherwise, Jenna would not have chosen to work with AIDS sufferers in Central America or to teach, and Barbara would not be devoting herself to public health in Africa. But that's the baggage that comes with public life. There are no private mistakes. I accepted it and moved on, and they did the same. Summer 2001 began with what would become the familiar whirlwind of travel. 5 countries in 5 days. Spain, Belgium, Sweden, Poland, and Slovenia. Those 5 days in Europe captured the routine of nearly all of our travels. Packed days with nations anxious to display their particular beauties and treasures, while others shared their struggles to face the dark episodes of their past. In mid-July, we were in Air Force One, high aloft the Atlantic, headed for our first visit to England. Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip had invited us for a luncheon at Buckingham Palace on perfectly pressed linens and china emblazoned with the royal coat of arms. Then we helicoptered over to meet Tony and Cherie Blair at Chequers, the 16th century summer house of England's prime ministers. We had hosted the Blairs at Camp David. Now they wanted to show us the same comfort in return. Chequers sits on grounds that have been recorded in history since Roman times. The name of the original estate was inscribed in the Domesday Book of 1086. Its name likely comes from a 12th century British landholder who was an official of the King's Exchequer. Its house is a medium-sized red brick Tudor mansion, completed in 1565, 55 years before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. Inside, Cherie showed me a ring that belonged to the first Queen Elizabeth and a table used by the French Emperor Napoleon during his exile. Despite its formal pedigree, our evening at Chequers was very casual. The Blairs' children were there along with one of their school friends, and Barbara had joined us with one of her school friends. The kids peppered everyone with questions, and it was a fast-moving conversation, covering everything from the merits of missile defense, George being the primary defender and Cherie the skeptic, to capital punishment. On that issue, the American president and the British prime minister's wife, a human rights lawyer, were on vastly different planes. But the debate was cordial. Cherie said no one, left or right, can claim that George doesn't have a very good sense of humor. When it was over and we all began making our way upstairs, I overheard the Blair's oldest son, Ewan, saying to Cherie, "Give the man a break, mother." By the end of the summer, I was finally hitting my stride in the White House. I had hosted my long-planned conference on early childhood cognitive development at Georgetown University. We had gotten away to our ranch in August, and my pet project, the National Book Festival, debuted on Saturday, September 8. On Friday night, we held a gala for the festival at the Library of Congress before the official day of author events. Dr. James Billington, the Librarian of Congress, introduced me. As the back of the stage opened, I walked out in a blue Arnold Scazzi dress with sheer chiffon and a short underskirt. The crowd gasped, and I felt as if this was my official debut as First Lady. Not quite 9 months after George took office, I was now doing what I loved, finding my place in the world of Washington and beyond.